now say, in all honesty, that our next speaker needs no introduction. But let's welcome him anyway, Guido, for your second talk.
Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. So, I should try and remind myself what I wanted to talk about this afternoon. The title is Probability, Arrow of Time, and Decoherence. In fact, it's going to be an updated repeat of a talk I gave here a year ago. Demand was there. So, as we saw this morning, the measurement problem of quantum mechanics is the problem of how to reconcile what appears to be the contradiction between the phenomenological theory of measurement, which seems to be indeterministic and seems to produce measurement results, and the Schrödinger equation, which is deterministic and does not seem to lead to any definite results at the end of a measurement. And the main strategies can be divided up in collapse approaches and no collapse approaches. Collapse approaches embrace the indeterminism. They take the phenomenological theory as seriously as possible and modify the Schrödinger equation, while no collapse approaches seek to explain the phenomenology and the probabilities as emerging from an underlying deterministic theory. What I have not mentioned yet is that the phenomenological collapse is in fact a time asymmetric process, while the Schrödinger equation is a symmetric equation. So one aspect of the measurement problem, which is not usually emphasized, but which is there, is how to reconcile the apparent contradiction between a phenomenological theory, which is time asymmetric, and a fundamental theory, which is time symmetric. And that seems to be an instance of the usual problem of the arrows of time in physics, as for instance reconciling thermodynamics and the underlying classical mechanics. It turns out that the main distinction between collapse and no collapse approaches matches perfectly the main alternative in the strategies to dealing with the problem of the arrow of time, namely, on the one hand, embracing the time asymmetry, taking that seriously, and trying to change the fundamental equations in order to incorporate the time asymmetry, versus trying to explain the time asymmetry as emerging in some appropriate sense from an underlying time symmetric theory. Now, let me give you just a very simple example to illustrate that the standard collapse process is time asymmetric. So we start off with a state of the form alpha plus beta minus, and now we couple that with a measuring apparatus in some initial state. And now, what happens in a measurement is, we let the system interact with an apparatus. So we couple. So the now the the interaction is going to couple these components of the quantity we are measuring with appropriate states of the apparatus. But then, so that's a unitary evolution from T naught to T zero. But then, at time T one, we have a projection. Now, suddenly the state collapses. A result appears. For instance, the result plus, and the state is reduced to only one of the two components. I've renormalized the state. Now this one has length one, and that's with probability alpha squared. If nothing else happens, that's the state further times. Just a Schrödinger equation. If the Schrödinger equation, if this evolution is trivial, that continues like that. Now, let's consider now the reverse process. So we start off with this state. Now that's the reverse process in red. We start off with that state, and then if we go from T2 to T1 according to Schrödinger equation, nothing happens. Now T1 is the time of the collapse. If we apply the collapse now to this state, so we project using that projection operator, again, nothing happens because there are no components besides the one defined by plus. Or if you want, this trivial projection happens with probability equals to one. And then if we apply the measurement interaction backwards, what this does is just going to undo the coupling, undo the measurement result. What we are going to get is the ready state of the apparatus, and we see that the sequence of states is not reversed, and the overall probability for what is happening is different. So the collapse process, unlike the standard Schrödinger equation, is not a time symmetric process. Okay. Now, what we want to do now, what we'll do today, this afternoon, is focus on no collapse approaches to the measurement problem, and we're going to discuss the aspect trying to explain the time asymmetry from the time symmetric Schrödinger equation, that aspect of the measurement problem. So we need to discuss how probabilities can emerge in no collapse approaches and under which conditions and in what sense they might indeed be said to be time asymmetric. This is where the notion of decoherence comes in. And in order to talk about decoherence, I think I need to spell out first the analogy between quantum mechanical states and waves. The Schrödinger wave function, so the quantum mechanical states a very, very abstract kind of way, for a variety of reasons, more abstract, well, much more abstract than waves in the sense of propagation of a vibration in a medium, and also more abstract than, for instance, the electromagnetic field, which is just a field in space-time. There's no ether that's vibrating. But at least for one particle, one can represent a quantum state vector as a complex wave on three-dimensional space, a so-called Schrödinger wave. For two or more particles, the state of a composite system is in general a linear combination of products of states of a single particle, we'll get functions of not three spatial variables, but six spatial variables, nine spatial variables, 12 spatial variables, and so on. A complex function over the space of configurations of the total system. But okay, for one particle, we can picture things in three-dimensional space. And now we're going to observe interference phenomena, which, like with every other kind of wave, means that different components of a wave may enhance each other or cancel out to various degrees once they come together in space. That happens with water waves, light waves. It happens with Schrödinger waves as well. And the prime example for that, John has mentioned it already this morning, is the two-slit experiment. And, since we didn't have a picture, I think I'll draw it now. What we have is we have some kind of source for our wave, call it psi, and then we've got a screen with two slits, and on the other side of the screen, we'll have propagation of two separate components of the wave, which we can write as P1 psi, P2 psi, call it psi1 and psi2 for short. And these will continue to propagate until they start overlapping, and they'll continue propagating also when they overlap. But where they overlap now, we can have either constructive or destructive interference. They can enhance each other, they can cancel each other out. The total wave is going to be the sum of the two waves, and when we get to the screen, what we'll observe is an interference pattern like the one we saw. We're going to have some regions of constructive interference or destructive interference, light spots light bands and dark bands. If I want to be contrary, Feynman said the interference, this two-slit experiment, is the one great mystery of quantum mechanics, and that depends very much how you analyze it, how you see it. If you start off with a picture of waves, then there's nothing strange about the interference. What is strange, instead, is the particulate behavior at the screen. The fact that you actually get single dots, and that's an instance of the measurement problem. And that problem is there whether or not we have two slits open, one slit open. There's very, very different ways of seeing where the mysteries of quantum theory lie. What the phenomenological theory of measurement tells us is that we'll have the pattern here. We'll be given by looking at that's going to be the density for detection of a particle at the screen. This is sort of coherence. What is decoherence? Decoherence is the spontaneous suppression of interference. How does that happen? Typically, what we have we can imagine that the particles that, or waves that we're shooting across, interact with some other system, cosmic particle, something, between the slits and the second screen where the measurements is actually made, so that instead of having just psi 1 plus psi 2, we'll have something like psi 1 times phi 1 plus psi 2 times phi 2. The psi's are going to be functions of three spatial coordinates, which represent the coordinates of the first particle, and the phi's are going to be functions of another group of three spatial coordinates representing standing for the second particle with which the first one has interacted. If the coupling is such that the system with which our particle is interacting is affected strongly by this interaction without some strong back reaction onto our original particle, what we'll have is indeed a state of this form where phi 1 and phi 2 tend to be orthogonal. That's what we mean by saying that they're strongly affected. They're strongly coupled to the difference in which component of the system we are considering. These two are going to be approximately orthogonal, which means in this representation, using Schrödinger waves, that if we integrate phi 1 complex conjugate times phi 2 over y, then that's going to be zero. That's a scalar product in the Hilbert space of square integrable complex functions on R3 in this case. Now, what happens to the pattern at the screen when we have an interaction of this sort? The phenomenological theory gives us exactly the same interpretation of this function as it gave us of that function. So if we want to calculate the probability of finding the two particles at x and at y, the quantity we need to look at is that one. That's a probability density. If we are interested in just where our favorite particle hits the screen, we have to take the marginal distribution. So we have to integrate out why? But what happens if we integrate out y? We are going to get integral of dy of it's four different terms. We are going to get psi 1 phi 1 plus psi 1 psi 2 phi 1 phi 2 plus psi 2 complex conjugate psi 1 phi 2 complex conjugate phi 1 plus. Okay, what I've done is just multiplied these out, and now because phi 1 and phi 2 are orthogonal, these two terms in the integral are going to be both separately zero, and because states are normalized, that those factors are going to be one. That is, we get that expression as our probability density for finding the particle on the screen instead of that expression. Now, this is the suppression of interference. What is that expression? Okay, we are just summing the probabilities which we will get for detection of the particle at the screen if we had had just one component or the other component. That is, if we had had only one slit open or the other slit open. So the interference pattern is destroyed. And this has happened spontaneously. We have contributed nothing. There was just some interaction which was out of our control between our particle, our system of interest, and some other particle in the environment. This is, in fact, just part of quantum mechanics. There are certain situations in which the standard equations of quantum mechanics lead to such a suppression of interference. Decoherence is just a phenomenon occurring within quantum mechanics itself. It's not a solution to the measurement problem. It tells us that in certain cases, the probabilities for detections or the probabilities for results of measurements as prescribed by the standard phenomenological theory of measurement will be as if at some intermediate time some other measurements had been carried out. If we formulate it like this, we rely on the phenomenological theory of measurement. This is not an alternative to it. It doesn't give us a way of deriving the existence of measurement results. But what it does? What it can provide is, or rather, combine. You know, once we have a scheme for making sense of the phenomenological theory of measurement, and this is in the case of no collapse approaches, so the pilot wave theory or a many worlds interpretation, then decoherence fits into such an approach in a way that's very useful. I've mentioned that modern day many worlds theories actually use decoherence as a criterion for when different components should be of the state should be considered as separate worlds. Something very similar happens in the pilot wave theory in cases of decoherence. The particles that are guided by the wave will be trapped into one of the components, and so that other components become irrelevant for the future behavior of the particles, and that explains in pilot wave theory why we have the appearance of a collapse to one of the components of the state. Okay, now let's just describe decoherence a little more abstractly. So instead of looking at predictions in case of measurement, let's just look formally at the Schrödinger wave for our total system and the formal expressions for probabilities. And now we can define decoherence as some condition involving formal expressions for probabilities for various things, we can do it this way. So let me just dress our example of a two-slit experiment in a slightly more abstract notation. So we start off with a certain state psi, and then at some time t1, we decide to decompose it into say two different components, p1 psi and p2 psi. So this state is decomposed into p1 psi and p2 psi. That's a slit. Let's notate the time in there. For people who know about this, I'm switching the notation to Heisenberg picture, but never mind. And then at some later time again, we consider all the various components of the state that arrive on the screen at different places. So now this is going to be sum over, and let's assume it's a discrete sum. Okay, so we are considering a kind of tree of various components, and now one can define decoherence in the following way. So we take the probability for hitting the screen in a small interval. So that's the length squared of the corresponding component. So that's going to be the corresponding component of the state, and the length is the scalar product of that vector with itself. Now we define decoherence as the idea that this, as the condition that this probability should be the sum of the probabilities for passing through the upper slit and then hitting the screen at x plus the probability for passing through the lower slit and hitting the screen at x. So that's going to be px t2 p1 of t1 times p1 of t1 px of t2 psi plus psi px t2 p2 of t1 p2 of t1 px of t2 psi. So what we have is the classical formula for total probability. We can sum over intermediate events. We have the sum of the probabilities involved. That would be psi 1 mod squared and psi 2 mod squared, instead of having to taking into account the cancelling out or mutual enhancing of the two. Of the two components. And now, this equality is going to hold if and only if the real part the corrected formula here will hold if and only if the real part of this cross term is zero, and the proof is really a two-liner, and I'll just write it down for you. So we've got that psi px of t2 of t2 psi. That thing is equal to psi p1 t1 plus p2 t2 px t2 px t2 p1 t1 plus p2 t1 psi. And now if we multiply this out, we get four terms. Two terms are these two, with p1, p1, and p2, p2. And two terms are the one with p1, p2, and p2, p1. The condition will be fulfilled if these two additional terms, the sum of those two, is zero. Equals, etc., etc., and it's going to equal just the sum of those two probabilities if indeed so we have decoherence if and only if psi of p1, let me just suppress those times, plus p2 px, px, p1, psi is zero. And these two things are the complex conjugates of each other, so we have that the real part of one of these has to be zero, and that's going to be equivalent to decoherence in this abstract, slightly more abstract setting. In our example of the two-slit experiment, both these two expressions were separately zero because this vector here projects onto a component that contains phi 2, this, the wave function in the environment, and this one projects over something that contains phi 1, and phi 1 and phi 2 are orthogonal, so this one is zero and this one is zero separately. If that is the case, if not just the real part, but that thing and therefore its complex conjugate, R0, we talk of strong decoherence, or sometimes medium decoherence, if that sum, that is the real part of this, is zero, we talk about weak decoherence. Okay, I'll just finish off this with some terminology and notation, and summarizing what we've said about. There isn't much more to be said about decoherence, really, all in this in this example. I just need to introduce some terminology. So we take a time-ordered set of projections chosen from sets of mutually orthogonal projections that sum up to the identity. And we call a history from a set of alternative and mutually exclusive histories. Now we say that a set of histories decoheres weakly or strongly with respect to some state psi if for any two distinct histories we have that, well, possibly the real part or not, of the trace PINTN PI1 T1 psi PI1 prime. So these are distinct histories. Just one index will need to be different to make the two histories distinct. So it's vanishing of what is called the decoherence functional. Here I've just introduced this trace notation, which we saw earlier. That's nothing special, really. Trace of that. That thing there is really a linear operator that maps phi into psi, and everything that's orthogonal to phi to zero. And the trace, in the simplest case, is just the sum of the diagonal elements of a linear operator. And it turns out that that thing is just the scalar product of those two. So that thing there is just the scalar product of that vector with that vector, as we had on the previous slide. It's actually convenient to use the trace because one can then generalize this this formula to the case where instead of just a vector, we are considering convex combinations of them as more general states. So that was just notation. If this condition is satisfied, then the corresponding diagonal elements of this decoherence functional, that is, when we have the same history on both sides, these expressions are identified as probabilities for the given histories. This more abstract characterization of decoherence is called the decoherent histories formalism, set up by Bob Griffiths, Gilman and Hartle, Roland Omnes. That's all the formalism we need. This looks abstract, but really it's just the example of the two-slit experiment with some intervening interaction, which we saw earlier. Okay, now what I want to say, is this. really, by looking at decoherence in this way, we seem to have got what we wanted. Under certain conditions on the state or on the dynamics, some appropriate set of histories will decohere, and this allows one to formally embed the collapse-style probabilities into the framework of the Schrödinger equation. And here we just have the Schrödinger equation, and we are looking at these formal expressions for probabilities. And then, once we feed in a no-collapse approach, such as the pilot wave theory or many worlds, these formal expressions for probabilities will actually be interpreted as probabilities in some sense or other, and we've managed to rederive the probabilities of the phenomenological theory within a no-collapse interpretation of the time-symmetric Schrödinger equation. However, most authors who work on decoherent histories don't see it that way, and they identify as a problem the fact that we seem to be able to embed these time asymmetric probabilities into the time symmetric framework of the Schrödinger equation, but we have done that through imposing a condition, the decoherence condition, on the state, on the histories, which is itself time asymmetric. Here we have the state, and we have a time-ordered string of projections here. If we invert the order of these projections, we get an inequivalent condition. This is a time asymmetric condition. So the standard analysis goes: we've put in the time asymmetry by hand. And what people tend to do is something that may be very useful in other contexts, but I think in this context is throwing away the baby with the bathwater. They introduce a second state we have then two quantum states, one that evolves from the past towards the future, one that evolves from the future towards the past. This other final state is inserted in the formula at this point, the final state. And in fact, in general, we do take more general states, these convex combinations of states of this form, because if both of these are just vector states, the decoherence condition turns out to be an almost impossibly strong constraint on the histories, on the probabilities. This turns out to be something that's completely symmetric because it's a rather trivial theorem that trace of AB is equals trace of BA for any two operators. The reason why I think this is throwing away the baby with the bathwater is that introducing these two states is a major modification of quantum mechanics, one that maybe is not currently is possibly not empirically warranted. It seems to just give up on the idea that the Schrödinger equation is a time-symmetric framework from which we should try and derive the time asymmetric probabilities. It's just giving up on that strategy. We give up the usual Schrödinger equation, we redouble the state, we do something completely different. And I think that's just not putting up a good fight when one should. And I'll just show you what people ought to do instead. Okay, we've got a problem with the fact that this condition, I'll just suppress the times there for sake of rapidity of writing. So we've got a problem with the fact that that condition is time asymmetric. Well, let's consider a pair of conditions in which we do invert the order of those. Sorry, that should be two distinct histories. In which we do invert the order of these projections. So what we are doing now, we are considering the possibility that the given set of histories would decohere forwards in time or backwards in time with respect to the state. And now one can show by example that it is possible to have states and sets of histories that will decohere in either one or the other, or both, or neither of the directions of time. Now, if we have decoherence only in one direction of time and not in the other direction of time, well, it's not our fault. It's not us who put in this condition by hand. It's a perfectly objective property of the state and the set of histories. It's some asymmetric relation of the state to the set of histories. There's nothing wrong with that. Schrödinger equation is a symmetric equation, but symmetric equations can have asymmetric solutions. It's perfectly objective feature of the state and the set of histories. That's really what we should be doing, looking at such a pair of conditions instead of modifying the condition and reduplicating the Schrödinger equation, blah, 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 blah. Let me see. What one can show is also that in the case in which both conditions are satisfied, the probabilities that can be defined for these histories using this formula or this formula coincide. And one can also show that satisfaction of both conditions is in fact inequivalent to this so-called time-neutral formula with the same state here and here, and that would be a much more restrictive condition than asking for these two to be satisfied. Let me see. Now, in the case in which both conditions are satisfied, it appears thus that although the asymmetric quantum probabilities can be embedded in the symmetric framework of the Schrödinger equation through the mechanism of decoherence. There are cases in which the same mechanism of decoherence also leads to the emergence of quantum probabilities that instead are symmetric. Okay, I mean, in the written version of the paper, I give an example in which both conditions are satisfied, but it's not a physically interesting example. It'd be very interesting to see whether one can construct some real meaty, physically interesting examples of this. Okay, now, how are we for time? I mean, I could stop here, or I could start talking philosophy of probability.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes to the end of the session.
Mm-hmm.
We're not allowing time at all for questions. I think perhaps it might be a good idea to stop now. Because I'd like to hear what you want to say about philosophy of probability.
Yeah, because I'd like to hear comments during the coffee break about what I'm about to say, so what I would say if we disallow a question.
Your choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Okie dokie. Well. All right. Yeah. Let me say a few things about probabilities if I can remember and read what I wrote at midnight last night. Okay, so so far what we've got is a purely formal discussion of time symmetry or asymmetry of quantum probabilities as arising in decoherence. A different question is that of the metaphysical picture behind the probabilities with respect to the direction of time, because very often one has a picture of probabilities as involving some kind of fixed past and open future. Now, as a general point, I want to suggest that formal issues like the one we've discussed may not have any sort of normative value in judging these metaphysical questions, but they may be useful in providing a guideline for what might be an appropriate interpretation for the probabilities one has been discussing at the formal level. Now, in the case of no collapse quantum mechanics, we thus have the case of time asymmetric probabilities that may emerge, depending on boundary conditions on the state, from the time symmetric Schrödinger equation, or of time-symmetric probabilities that may emerge by the same mechanism. And I think this suggests caution in the kind of metaphysical picture one wants to impose on these probabilities. And that would be then, in the context of some approach to, pilot wave theory or many worlds that will come with their own interpretation of the probabilities. But now there's a different kind of question. So here we're talking about forwards decoherence and backwards decoherence. Now there's a different question, which is related to the time directness of probabilities, and that's the behavior of probability with respect to Boltzmann's time bomb, as Hugh calls it. And that's the idea that any emerging direction of time due to some special initial conditions, say, may be trumped by some special final conditions. So specific, for instance, thermodynamic behavior may turn into anti-thermodynamic behavior and may even be witnessed as such by some observers. In our case, what we have is what seems to be the emergence of a collapse behavior and the idea that it might turn into anti-collapse behavior. What I want to claim now is that even if from a God's eye perspective, that's perfectly possible, from the internal perspective of an observer who's witnessing the collapse behavior, this cannot happen. The problem of Boltzmann's time bomb arises in our case because, satisfaction of the decoherence condition for a set of histories between the times T1 and Tn does not guarantee that at later times we will have no interference, no recoherence of the histories. Which incidentally is something that's quite separate from the issue of backwards decoherence. It's more to do with the backwards decoherence of a time-reversed set of histories, for times minus T1 to minus Tn. Formally, it's quite a separate issue. The way I want to substantiate my claim is the following. And in a sense, it's rather unsurprising, but it's this. Any observer of a collapse-type event will have a memory of that event. But as long as such a memory exists, which is just like the states phi 1 and phi 2 in the environment in our example of the two-slit experiment, no further interference can happen. In order to have recoherence, reinterference of the different components, that memory has to disappear. Say the states phi 1 and phi 2 both have to evolve into the same state phi. This is something which is called quantum erasure. But if that is the case, then any observer who has witnessed a collapse-type event cannot be said to witness the recoherence event. They will lack the conceptual resource. They won't be able to describe it as a recoherence event. From an external God's eye perspective, that may happen. But what I think is the case is that from the internal perspective of an observer, from a God's eye perspective, decoherence and recoherence are just two time-reversed descriptions of the same phenomenon. But what I'm saying is that from an internal perspective, some observer with functioning memories, some observer like us, such a process can be described only in the decohering direction. So in summary, questions of time directedness in the interpretation of probabilities in no collapse quantum mechanics need to take into account two types of issues. The issue of forwards versus backwards decoherence, which suggests the possibility that contingently one will have both time-directed and time-undirected probabilities, and the issue of decoherence versus recoherence, which then leads to some genuine time directedness, but of a perspectival kind. So caution is in order, I would like to have some feedback to be able to assert some conclusions with more positive conclusions, with more confidence. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, in the interest of timeliness, let's go and give Guido his feedback over coffee and reconvene in about 15-20 minutes' time. Thank you, Guido.